Okay, so my theory is that it's all part of some sort of billionaire euthanasia club. Not voluntary euthanasia, mind you. Rather, someone taking it upon themselves to rid the world of these wealthy wastes of space in such a way that doesn't look deliberate, instead making their demise look like an inevitable result of their own hubris and sense of entitlement. Believe me, the loss of multiple billionaires on that Titan submersible, supposedly taking them to view the wreck of the Titanic, is just the start of it. I mean, what's that you say? It's too soon to be joking about this tragedy? Who's joking? Besides, I'm tired of all the sanctimonious cobblers that have been written already about the loss of that submarine and its occupants. It culminated with that human pile of offal, Boris Johnson writing in his new overpaid Daily Mail column. I mean, who the hell wants to read anything from that blubbering piece of crap? Anyway, he was writing about how there were some kind of pioneers pushing the frontiers of human knowledge, or some such bollocks. Let's be very clear about this. They are a bunch of very privileged people with more money than sense who are prepared to pay a lot of this money to get into what amounted to an uncertified tin can, in order to dive several miles down into the Atlantic, in order to gawp at what amounts to an underwater mass grave. That's not exploration. That's not pushing the frontiers of human knowledge. It's tourism. Worse, it's misery tourism aiming to get some kind of kick from wallowing in the misfortune of others. I mean, if nothing else, it must surely further undermine the myth that billionaires are in any way exceptional, that they're in any way more intelligent than us mere mortals, or exhibit better judgment. Because after all, nobody in their right mind would surely ever have set foot on that obvious death trap of a submarine. Not that we really needed any more proof of their fallibility than Elon Musk's stewardship of Twitter, where his utter cluelessness is on display daily. But I hear you say, if they're all such idiots, then how do you explain the fact that they became billionaires in the first place? Surely that indicates a level of savviness above and beyond the ordinary. Well, bearing in mind that most of them came from money in the first place, makes their financial rise look a little less remarkable. It's pretty easy to be a success in just about any field when you have the safety net of daddy's money to fall back on. And let's face it, those family fortunes were themselves often derived from very dubious sources. So very few of these fated billionaires are truly self-made. There are, well, I mean, I can't stand Sir Alan Sugar, for instance. I think he's an utter knobhead. But, while merely a millionaire rather than a billionaire, he did at least really start at the bottom with a market stall. He didn't have any fortunes to inherit or subsidise him, so he had to make money off his own back, which I can respect. That's completely unlike, though, the vast majority of our current crop of billionaires who blight this planet. I mean, you want more evidence as to why modern billionaires are complete dicks? Just look at that other billionaire event the other week, the aforementioned Musk challenging Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg to a cage fight. Really? Have these supposed business masterminds really have nothing better to do? I mean, there's all these things they could be doing with their money if they want to leave some lasting legacy in the world, like solving world hunger or ending homelessness in the United States, or whatever. There's all sorts of things they could do. But no, they play their silly games. And it just reveals them as the immature juveniles they actually are. But to get back to my original point, though, is there some kind of billionaire euthanasia club in operation? Because it seems to me that stroking their egos by offering them the chance to do something nobody else can, simply because they're filthy rich, is the perfect way to lure these clowns into a trap. Get them to dive to the Titanic, then make sure the submarine implodes before it ever gets there. Tragic accident. No suggestion of foul play. Perhaps they're dead before they ever got on the sub. Maybe there's a gas chamber on the support ship. Maybe they just pumped gas. They got them into the submarine, then pumped gas in to kill them. Then they, you know, either that, as I say, they gassed on the ship, loaded the bodies into that metal coffin and dropped it into the ocean. Obviously, this method can't be a viable option anymore, as the tragedy is likely to get such trips to the Titanic banned for the foreseeable future. And then even if they do resume, they'll have so many safety checks and counter and, you know, safety measures on them. Doing this just wouldn't work. So what next instead? Space travel, perhaps. Could it be that all those private space initiatives are really false flag operations, unwittingly financed by the very billionaires who are destined to die in their amateur spaceships? What an irony if the likes of Richard Branson or Elon Musk, him again, were to pile into one of their space planes or rockets with a whole bunch of their billionaire buddies, only for the spacecraft to explode on launch or re-entry, or just be lost in space. The perfect act of involuntary euthanasia. There'd be even less evidence left than in the submarine accident. The kick would be if the fees that these idiots had paid for these experiences were then being used by those organising the billionaire euthanasia club to actually do stuff like finance the end of global food poverty or end homelessness. Just a thought.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are about to see a very unusual trailer about a very unusual picture coming to this theater.
This trailer is unusual because we aren't going to show you any scenes out of the picture, but we are going to tell you the truth.
Arch Obler's new motion picture, The Bubble, is made in a revolutionary new process called Space Vision. And when you come here to see it, we promise you a brand new sensation. I'll repeat that. We promise you a brand new sensation. Why? Because for the first time in any theater, scenes in colorful living dimensions will actually float right off the screen into space and over your heads. That's what I said, over your heads.
In addition, we believe The Bubble is a very entertaining story about most unusual people in a situation you'll talk about for a long time to come. So here's your flat invitation to see Arch Obler's The Bubble when it premieres in this theater.
It's revolutionary. It's exciting. It's newer than television. It's space vision. In all your life, you've never seen anything like it. That's a guarantee.
You'll meet Deborah Wally, an exciting new young actor named Michael Cole, and Johnny Desmond in a great suspense picture.
First, the screen was silent.
Then it talked.
Then color.
Now, the greatest advance of them all, the picture floats off the screen.
See motion picture history made in this theater in Arch Obler's exciting story, The Bubble.
The picture floats off the screen.
Arch Obler's The Bubble from 1966 is something of an oddity. A film that feels like an overextended episode of the director's radio anthology series and later TV series Lights Out, or even The Twilight Zone. Despite the fact that it's in colour, it feels almost as if it could have been made a decade earlier, with the use of 3D reinforcing that feeling that has been time-warped from the 50s. Which is rather apt for a film which is about a group of people who stumble into a seemingly time-warped town. The Bubble, the title, is a force field which seems to surround a small town and its surrounding area, which three people, including a woman about to give birth, somehow penetrate in a light plane during a storm. The town itself seems to be a mishmash of elements from various geographical eras and even times. The bar, for instance, seems vaguely Old West, while other parts of the area, like the hospital, seem to be from the 30s. While its inhabitants seem to be pre-programmed, they go through the same routines and conversations over and over like a stuck record. A taxi driver forever asks "Cab, mister," of anybody who approaches him. A bartender responds to every question by asking "What'll it be?" Nobody eats, nobody drinks. Instead, the population visit a throne-like device in a strange structure at regular intervals, where their energy is apparently recharged and their programming reinforced. Those who malfunction, failing to follow their predetermined routines, find themselves whisked skywards and swallowed by a black shape that periodically looms over the town, blocking out the sun. all of which sets up an interesting premise, which unfortunately is never really exploited to its full extent. The main problem lies with the pacing, which is painfully slow, with the three outsiders laboriously putting together the clues to finally speculate that the town represents some kind of alien experiment, the bubble allowing them to observe humans as if they were in an ant farm. Consequently, the film was at least 20 minutes too long, and indeed a 70s re-release titled Fantastic Invasion of Planet Earth was cut to around 90 minutes. And in its latter stages, it begins to sorely try the viewer's patience. It seems to take the trio of interlopers forever to even notice that anything is amiss, even when the people they meet keep repeating the same routines and replying with the same words over and over. Which brings us back to the idea that the script might have originated as a half-hour radio show, a feeling that is reinforced by the underwhelming climax. For an anthology show like Lights Out, the climax would have been the shock reveal that the town and all its inhabitants are trapped in a bubble, under observation and doomed to repeat the same day over and over. A feature film, of course, requires more than this to bring up its running time to acceptable length, hence the visitor's overextended investigation into what's going on in the town. The unfortunate result of this is that the three outsiders' actions in the town themselves feel repetitive, as they constantly try to get people to respond beyond their regular scripts or step outside of their fixed routines. The sheer talkiness of the script, with characters all too often telling us about what is going on rather than the film showing us, is a characteristic of Obler's films. His background was in radio and theatre, as is the tendency towards a certain preachiness of tone. The film really needed a much stronger cast to properly do justice to its ideas, but instead employs second-tier performers more familiar from TV and B-movies, like Michael Cole or Deborah Wally or Gidget Mark II and Johnny Desmond. Unfortunately, they never managed to make their characters any more than two-dimensional, never giving the audience anybody in the film to really engage with or care about. It also doesn't help that the scenario presented by the script is inconsistent. Despite being entrenched in set daily routines, the hospital staff, for instance, seem to be capable of dealing with unplanned events as they successfully deliver the pregnant interloper's baby and consequently care for her and the child. Indeed, the local doctor does seem to have some awareness of the situation, at one point telling the protagonist that they haven't gone to their assigned start points. The other members of the local community simply repeat a single phrase in response to any attempt at interaction, becoming completely passive if forcibly removed from their established location and routine. Moreover, the relative lack of action over the film's overlong running time combines with a generally cheap look to the sets to give the whole movie the feel of a B-movie rather than the A-feature it's clearly intended to be. While Arch Obler might not have been the most visually inspired of film directors, he was an acclaimed writer noted for his intelligent and thought-provoking scripts and plays, so it's no surprise that The Bubble should be full of interesting ideas. Unfortunately, in their execution, they never really coalesce into a satisfying whole. I mean, while it might be possible to read all sorts of interpretations into it as pertains to, I don't know, free will, predetermination, government surveillance perhaps, social control, or even perhaps as an analogy for communism, it's never coherent enough to be definite about any of these things. Nevertheless, despite its deficiencies, though, The Bubble remains an intriguing film, setting up a premise that might seem familiar nowadays, but at the time was reasonably original for a film. And indeed, various parts of its concept would subsequently be reworked by numerous films and TV series. I mean, the idea of characters trapped in a time loop turns up in the 70s Doctor Who story, Carnival of Monsters, for instance. Well, with the 90s film Forgotten, using the image of people being hoisted skywards by aliens. Well, Under the Dome, the TV Stephen King-inspired TV series, lifts the whole bubble concept itself, lock, stock and barrel. Its main shortcoming is that it fails to exploit its ideas sufficiently and never properly follows up on all of the interesting plot strands it sets up. adding to the film's curiosity value is the fact it's filmed in the Space Vision 3D process. And Obler was a 3D loyalist, having directed the first released 3D film, Wanna Devil, in 1953. Now, this particular process, Space Vision, while still requiring the audience to wear stereoscopic glasses, could shoot the film in 3D using conventional cameras fitted with special lenses. Whether 3D enhanced the film on its original release, I can't say, as I've only seen it on TV in 2D. But a lot of stuff does get thrown or pointed at the screen. For all its flaws, The Bubble remains worth watching, even if its ambition ultimately outstrips its resources, a common feature of Arch Obler's productions.
Various invaders from another galaxy in fantastic invasion of planet Earth. In 3D.
Something up there watching me.
Unholy overlords with their fiendish, diabolical mind machine.
You want to paralyze your brains? You want to forget that you're a human being?
Well, how could it have done all this so quickly?
Well, why should time to them be the same as it is to us?
It wants to kill my baby.
Don't touch Tommy, I swear it.
There's nothing you can do.
Well, come on!
Are we really here? Or is it some kind of a crazy dream?
Fantastic invasion of planet Earth. A thrilling science fiction adventure for the entire family.
This may be all that's left of our world.
Fantastic invasion of planet Earth in 3D. Space Vision. So realistic it pulls you into the picture. Don't miss it. Rated PG. Coming soon to this theater.
Now, do you remember that film where Frank Sinatra and his buddies salvaged a sunken U-boat and used it to hold up an ocean liner? Assault on the Queen, it was called. Made in the 60s. And of course, these days, a title like that would probably be mistaken for a harrowing drama about homophobic violence. But in this case, the queen of the title was the liner Queen Mary, as I recall, back before she was moored up in California as a tourist attraction. Anyway, it came to mind to me recently when I was reading about the capsizing of that boat full of refugees near Greece, resulting in possibly hundreds of deaths. What if it wasn't an accident, I speculated, but what if some bunch of right-wing anti-immigration loonies had secretly salvaged a U-boat and were using it to torpedo such vessels? Okay, I know that I often rail against right-wing kooks using public tragedies as opportunities to push their anti-immigration agenda. But bear with me on this. I'm not pushing anything here except a perfectly legitimate hatred of Nazis. And besides, I have satirical intent here. No, really, I do. Because these bastards do sort of have form for this. Chartering boats to try and disrupt operations to rescue refugees in the Mediterranean, for instance, or calling for every small boat in North Africa to be sunk by the RAF in order to stop them from being used by refugees and asylum seekers. Of course, when I say anti-immigration loonies, I actually mean the likes of Nigel Farage. But obviously, if I was to mention his name, that might be libelous, so I won't. But if anyone was to make a modern version of Assault on the Queen, it might well feature a villain who looks a bit like Farage, captaining a salvage submarine that cruises the English Channel, attempting to sink small dinghies full of asylum seekers. Actually, to be fair, he and his merry men would probably be targeting the RNLI lifeboats trying to rescue stricken asylum seekers. They'd probably wait until they'd picked up the occupants of several small boats and were heading home before torpedoing them, so as to ensure maximum casualties. Obviously, if such a person, like Nigel Farage, but not like Nigel Farage, were to captain a sub under such circumstances, it'd probably run aground off Felix Stowe or end up beached at Dover. Plus, if this was a contemporary version of the story, they'd have to change the origin of the salvaged submarine. I doubt very much there are any U-boat wrecks left that are even close to salvageable. I mean, so maybe my first thoughts here were maybe a sunken Russian or North Korean submarine. I mean, one of the diesel-powered ones rather than the nuclear-powered boat. After all, we wouldn't want to make it seem too implausible. So no nukes of any kind. And after all, surely even right-wing loonies wouldn't be so crazy as to want to use nuclear weapons against unarmed immigrants, would they? But then I got to thinking, you know, what sort of person might, on the right, might already have a private submarine or have had a private submarine? And I thought, you know, bearing in mind what set me off on this was a tragedy in the Mediterranean, you know, maybe Silvio Berlusconi, the late Prime Minister of Italy, yeah, also media baron and general all-round degenerate and quasi-fascist. What if he'd had a secret submarine that he bought off of the Italian Navy or something, where he regularly invited his millionaire neo-fascist friends to, in order to hold his so-called bunga bunga parties safe from the prying eyes of the paparazzi. Yeah. Yeah, that could be the origin. Because, I mean, what you could have in this story is the bunga bunga sub had sunk on its last time out. You know, they basically pack it full of prostitutes and drugs and load aboard all these millionaire nutcases and then go down to sink, basically submerged to the bottom of the Bay of Naples. But what if on one of these excursions something gone wrong, like, I don't know, one of his guests deciding, you know, to increase their sexual thrill level, they'd not only have sex with a prostitute in one of the torpedo tubes, but they try perhaps firing themselves out, you know, as they reach the climax, so to speak, of the deed. And of course, you could see that would all go wrong. The submarine would be flooded and everybody have to escape, and Silvio Berlusconi's hair transplant would probably be ruined by the salt water. But there'd be this submarine, perfectly intact, just flooded, sat at the bottom of the Bay of Naples, ready to be salvaged once Berlusconi's dead. By some of his former associates on the extreme right. And then they put it to use, sailing around the Mediterranean, or the English Channel or wherever, like some kind of modern day neo-Nazi Captain Nemo, sinking the world's refugee boats. It's just a thought, okay? Just a thought. You know, I'm not suggesting any of this might be true. Just a thought.
Do you know how to get to the LA International Airport? Hurry.
Out of the skies and onto your lap come the stewardesses of Flyme.
Hi, I'm Toby. The seats in my plane aren't the only things that recline.
They take off into wild adventure and take on the passengers anywhere they can.
I can do it.
Well, allow me.
Oh.
I'm a doctor.
Three American stewardesses swinging on overseas service are swept into a whirlpool of international intrigue, hijacked into the shadowy world of white slavery in the underworld of the Orient.
Mama, I'm not going to leave until I say goodbye to
you. I put a virgin on the plane in Los Angeles. I'll put a virgin on the plane in Hong Kong.
Take a flight on the wild side with the stewardesses of Flyme. Action, Oriental style. They battle the flying feet of kung fu killers. High-flying stewardesses with a man in every port. The sky's the limit with these cockpit cuties. They're your passport with fun and wild excitement.
Hey, don't you want to stay and watch the grow?
Break the sex barrier with the stewardesses of Fly Me.
I won flight you won't want to miss. Fly Me. Rated R.
1973's Fly Me is one of dozens of similar movies put out during the 70s under the auspices of Roger Corman's New World Pictures. Some followed the exploits of nurses, other young female teachers, international fashion models, or, as here, air stewardesses. These are, I suppose, the sort of US equivalent to British sex comedies. So Fly Me is typical of the format. Following a trio of stewardesses, one of them new to the job, on a series of adventures in Hong Kong and the Philippines. In actual fact, virtually all of it was filmed in the Philippines. Each of the main protagonists go off on separate plot threads. One searches for a missing boyfriend. One gets kidnapped by white slavers. She's been smuggling drugs for the gang, but lost part of a shipment. Well, the rookie is romanced by a doctor she meets as a passenger, while having to deal with an interfering mother who's gone along for the trip. The wildly differing nature of the three plot threads gives the film a decidedly uneven tone, veering from grim drama with violence and threats of rape in the white slaver storyline, broad comedy in the rookie stewardess story, and some bizarre action scenes turn up in the third stewardess's attempt to find a missing boyfriend. To be fair, the film does finally bring all three plots together for the climax, with the new stewardess getting kidnapped by the white slavers, who, of course, are led by the missing boyfriend, with the infatuated doctor and an undercover cop coming to the rescue, and the whole thing resulting in some more kung fu fighting. All in less than 75 minutes. In reality, a Philippine production masquerading as American, Fly Me was directed by the prolific Sirio H. Santiago, who turned up many similar pictures put out by New World. Of note is the fact that the seemingly random kung fu fights that punctuate one stewardess's search for a boyfriend, when gangs of kung fu killers keep appearing seemingly from nowhere to assault her as she wanders around Hong Kong and Manila, but luckily she too is a martial arts expert. Anyway, these sequences were apparently supervised by the young Jonathan Demme. Ultimately, though, Fly Me is cinematic fluff, a film of no real consequence. But it goes down so many unexpected byways and includes so much bizarre action in its short running time that it's always entertaining, pure exploitation. It has all the required elements, captive women, sex, nudity, violence, prostitution. I tell you something, it's none the worse for that.
Flying out of the sky left, here come the stewardesses of Fly Me.
Hi, I'm Sherry. Buy a ticket and I come free.
Four American stewardesses hijacked into wild adventure, battling the flying fists of kung fu killers. Action, oriental style.
Yeah.
Love, the American way. Take a flight on the wild side with the stewardesses of Fly Me.
Fly Me, rated R.
When I was very young, and we're talking primary school or even pre-primary school age here, I vaguely remember having seen a TV programme that looked, I think, at ancient explorers' maps and the like. The thing about it that I clearly remember, though, were the various fabulous beasts that these ancients had chronicled, illustrated with the depictions on them, of them found on old maps. The headless men, who had their faces on their chests, in particular, captured my young imagination. The sea serpents, manticores, dog-headed men, monopods, etc. were all great. But those headless guys, who apparently lived in Libya, just seemed somehow more credible to the young me. Credible to the extent that I recall believing, for a few of those early years, that they might actually have existed. Obviously, I outgrew this belief, recognising that the headless men were simply creatures of myth, which, like many travellers' tales, gained traction at a time when huge tracts of the world lay unexplored by Western civilizations. A natural human desire to believe that the weird and exotic exists in those places that we haven't yet brought into the normality of our civilization, imposing our ideas of order and rationality upon them in the process of doing so, led to their persistence. Indeed, reports of headless men persisted well into the Middle Ages, their location shifting in accordance to the expanding boundaries of Western European exploration. Ethiopia became their new home, then India and Myanmar, before later explorers placed them in South America. Eventually, like the younger me, the majority of rational people outgrew their belief in the headless men. Recognizing that there simply was no evidence of their existence, that they were simply creatures of myth, the product of explorers' and writers' imaginations. Yet there are those who seem very resistant to giving up on belief in unproven phenomena, most of the evidence for which is dubious and anecdotal at best. I mean, recently, for instance, we've seen the latest spate of UFO-related reports all over social media, and even in some mainstream media. While aliens might well exist, the fact that there's never been any credible evidence of their presence here on Earth doesn't deter the UFO enthusiasts. After all, if aliens have been coming here as frequently and for as long as they claim, you'd think there'd be some clear physical evidence, or they would have made contact with the human race in ways other than kidnapping neurotics and enabling their sexual fantasies. But of course, like all conspiracists, the UFO lobby avoid proper explanation by resorting to the government cover-up standby, which is the crux of the latest revelations that numerous governments have recovered crashed alien spacecraft and have tried to exploit their technology. This time around, the whistleblower is some guy claimed to have worked in various US government projects and who supposedly has all sorts of high-level security clearances. Maybe he does. But the possession of such clearances doesn't guarantee that someone isn't mentally ill, a pathological liar, a fantasist, a grifter, an attention seeker, or just a plain old crackpot making stuff up. Hell, you know, a long time ago, I worked in a government post that required me to have all sorts of security clearances, all the way up to top secret, and including all sorts of handling caveats as it happens. But I make shit up and put it out on the web all the time. I mean, damn it, I have a whole website dedicated to it. It's important to note here that the headless men I believed in as a small child were also chronicled by what, at the time, were considered credible sources. Damn it, even Sir Walter Raleigh, one of the most renowned explorers of his day, reported on their existence in South America. And he wasn't the only then-respected explorer who claimed evidence for their existence. But like much of the UFO reporting we see, they and other explorers and writers were, as it turned out, relying upon the anecdotal evidence of others, repeating oft-told stories which became ever more elaborate with each retelling. To be fair, their origins most likely lay in misidentification by Europeans either of apes or monkeys that moved with their heads held low, or even local peoples who moved with similar stances, which, of course, is relevant to the whole UFO phenomena. Nobody denies that there's sometimes stuff in the sky that can't easily be identified, but it is worth bearing in mind that the last invasion of such objects shot down by the US Air Force turned out to be balloons.
They were like kids the world over. Nice kids, ordinary kids, full of fun and imagination. If you push them over, they'll roll to their feet. But if you push them too far, they'll kill you.
You ever see the Nazis put your father in front of a machine gun? You ever lie down and watch them take your mother, your sister? Nobody's gonna tell me what we are. How about we're gonna do? Nobody!
Captain Turner. In 15 minutes, he went from company commander to sole survivor. And now he had a handful of children to do the job of 50 professionals. Captain Turner's Baby Brigade. When they get hurt, they cry. When they get mad, they kill.
You're gonna show us how to shoot these guns.
Okay. But where are they going to blow up with all this dynamite? Railroad depot, town hall, De La Notte Dam.
And you had 15 boys, some of them not much more than babies.
Load up with live ammo.
Vengeance can make men out of boys, especially when they've got nothing more to lose. This was World War II in one small corner of Italy. No children allowed unless accompanied by a machine gun. And these were the commandos of the Hornet's Nest. Give them a ball, and they'll make up a game. Give them a chance, and they'll blow up the world.
Come on, baby.
Budget World War II movies, more often than not on an epic scale, became a staple of 60s cinema, kick-started apparently by the success of The Longest Day in 1962. But as the decade closed, returns and such films went into decline, with titles like The Battle of Britain in 1969 disappointing at the box office. So it shouldn't have been surprising to the makers of Hornet's Nest, released in 1970, that the film would turn out to be a box office flop. That said, they did their best to try and tailor the film to the era's changing tastes and audiences, with a supporting cast of juveniles that was clearly aimed at a younger demographic. Moreover, with its story of naive youth being led into violent conflict by an American soldier, it was also doubtless intended as some kind of commentary on the situation in Vietnam at the time. Perhaps the producers had hoped that the film might tap in to anti-Vietnam War sentiment amongst youth audiences. At the same time, the levels of violence on display seemed to be inspired by contemporary spaghetti westerns and Italian war movies, rather than the old traditional entries in the genre. Whatever the maker's intent, it apparently failed, as Hornet's Nest failed to find an audience at the time of its release, and remains rarely seen today. Condemned at the time for its depictions of violence employed both by and against children, it comes over as a cynical exercise, clearly attempting to elicit sympathy from the audience when some of the juvenile partisans are killed by the Germans, yet still expecting that same audience to cheer the kids on when they ruthlessly mow down Germans by the dozen. Indeed, the film's biggest problem lies in its failure to provide the viewer with any particularly sympathetic characters to identify with. Rock Hudson is surprisingly uncharismatic as the sole survivor of a US commando unit parachuted behind enemy lines in Italy to blow up a dam, while the child partisans he then uses as substitutes for his soldiers are characterised as practically feral, bloodthirsty and looking for excuses for violence even before Hudson sets them on their mission. While the film tries to provide some justification of their violent nature, they witness their parents executed by the SS, it never convinces. The female German doctor, played by Sylvia Koskina, forced into assisting the injured Hudson by the children, is also poorly characterised, never seeming to know which side she is really on, a supposed concern for the welfare of the children, and objections to Hudson's militarisation of them, ringing hollow in view of the regime that she loyally serves. Likewise, the main German military character, played by Sergio Fantoni, is someone we are clearly supposed to view as a good German. After all, he's regular army rather than SS, and even shoots an overzealous SS officer. But he's still guilty of a fair share of mowings down of unarmed civilians. Further alienating the audience from the main characters is the fact that the doctor finds herself subjected to sexual assault twice, once by the older boys, later by Hudson. Well, these blurrings of the moral lines that are supposed to separate the good guys from the bad guys is doubtless intentional, part of the film's commentary on war. They ultimately serve to weaken the film's impact. After all, why should we care when any of the boys are killed when they're a bunch of rapists? Hornet's Nest was a US-Italian co-production, which results in another big problem. It was made at a time when the Italian film industry was busily trying to whitewash Italy's war record and disassociate the country from its wartime fascist leadership and alliance with Nazi Germany. This was seen in many indigenously produced Italian war movies of the 60s and 70s, which rarely featured Italian soldiers as protagonists, instead casting their Italian leads as British or American soldiers and presenting the Germans as dyed-in-the-wool villains. While most of these films seem to focus on the war in North Africa, the absence of Italian forces, despite Italy's heavy involvement in earlier stages of the desert conflict, doesn't seem too incongruous. Hornet's Nest, however, goes a stage further, pretty much presenting Italy as an occupied country under the heel of their brutal German overlords. Well, it's true that by 1944, when the film is set, large parts of Italy had surrendered to the Allies. Much of the north of the country remained under fascist control. And the fact that the Allies haven't liberated the area depicted in the film implies that it must lie in the north. And with the Italian military units loyal to Mussolini actively supporting German forces in these areas. But if we're to believe Hornet's Nest, there were never any indigenous fascists in any part of Italy, and nobody ever supported those German units. A similar whitewashing occurs in another US-Italian World War II epic from a couple of years earlier, Anzio, which fails to depict the Italian SS units that opposed the Allied forces after the Anzio landings. Once again, only the German army is present. In hindsight, of course, the casting of Rock Hudson in the lead gives another perspective to the film. A closeted homosexual at the time, Hudson seemed to specialise in playing extremely masculine heroes in action films around this time. Sporting a moustache and frequently wearing a sleeveless vest to emphasise his manly physique, his performance in Hornet's Nest now seems like a parody of such macho characters. Perhaps the film's producers were aware of this at the time. His character's rape of the German doctor seems to be there mainly to emphasise his masculine credentials, the scene otherwise feeling somewhat jarring and out of left field. Most likely, though, Hudson's characterisation was meant as a parody of the sort of macho heroes usually featured in these sorts of films, whose ultra-masculinity always threatens to teeter on the edge of psychopathy and sadism. The fact that Hudson was, in private, gay was purely coincidental. Nonetheless, the film has become the target of the usual sort of homophobic commentary that highlights the sight of a gay man leading a bunch of young boys in a violent endeavour. As always, confusing homosexuality and paedophilia. More interesting, of course, is the fact that all of the supposed masculine traits such commentators seem to think define a real man can be successfully simulated in film after film by a gay man. Hornet's Nest is, all of its problems aside, a very good-looking movie, directed with a sure hand by Phil Carlson, and featuring excellent location work and cinematography. It at least moves at a decent pace. The action scenes are also well staged and competently executed, no matter that some of them are pretty ludicrous. But the slickness of the film's production simply serves to emphasise the cynicism of its subject matter, as it puts a cast of unlikable characters through a series of increasingly unbelievable set pieces and serves as some very confused messaging. War is hell, especially for children, who end up damaged by the experience, it seems to be saying. Except that we didn't really need to see them variously killed, injured, and themselves committing multiple killings, not to mention a sexual assault, in order to know this. The whole presentation comes over as exploitative rather than as genuinely wanting to make any kind of profound statements about the effects of war on children.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red. A horse is a horse, of course, of course, and no one can talk to a horse, of course. That is, of course, unless the horse is the famous Mr. Ed. Go right to the source and ask the horse. He'll give you the answer that you endorse. He's always on a steady course. Talk to Mr. Ed.
Now, I've got to stop watching all these old US TV shows on the various dubious streaming channels I can get via Roku. I mean, I swear to God, until a couple of weeks ago, I'd never seen an episode of Mr. Ed in my life. Yet now, I pretty much know the words to the theme song by heart. Now, Mr. Ed, if you didn't know, for those of us who didn't grow up in the US, was a sitcom about a talking horse, which was popular in the States in the early 60s. As it turns out, it's surprisingly weird, and not just because its main character is a horse that talks, but only to his owner Wilbur. Although, these days, of course, if you had a scenario like that, it'll be heavily implied that Wilbur was in fact suffering from some kind of mental delusion that his horse talked to him. Like that Australian series with the dog, the guy who kept thinking, saw his dog as a guy in a dog suit, and you know, I it was one of those things I just couldn't be bothered to watch the last series of, so I don't know how that turned out. But anyway, Mr. Ed really does talk, because whilst he only talks to Wilbur directly, he's the only human he speaks to directly, he does speak to people on the phone, over the phone, whatever, when they're not aware he's a horse, and etc. So, you know, he really does talk. Anyway, the point is, though, that, as I say, it's all a bit weird and creepy, though, because not only is Mr. Ed himself a bit of a lech, I mean, he's always telling Wilbur about his latest conquests amongst the local population of fillies, but he's also something of a voyeur, frequently wandering out of his stable to peer through neighbours' windows and eavesdrop on their conversations. I mean, I recently caught a particularly bizarre episode from 1962, in which Mr. Ed makes threatening phone calls to Clint Eastwood, who plays himself. Apparently, he's recently moved into Mr. Ed's neighbourhood. And unfortunately, Clint Stallion has been muscling in on Ed's filly action. So he launches a campaign of harassment to try and get the actor to move away. And this includes arranging for Eastwood to share a party line with Wilbur so that Ed can listen in on and interrupt his phone calls. It's all very strange. As I say, yeah, it's all pretty weird. And for what's generally remembered as a light-hearted fantasy sitcom aimed at family audiences, pretty creepy. But I'm sure that's how the makers got away with some darkly humorous and off-kilter subject matter here. They could always shrug off criticisms of its content by pointing out it's just a silly sitcom about a talking horse. You know, if you're reading other things into it, it's just your dirty mind. As I say, it's about a talking horse. A talking horse, however, who's a self-confessed snooper and sex pest. Well, at least as far as the local population of mares and fillies is concerned. But unlike Mr. Ed, I had previously seen episodes of The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, which originally ran for two seasons between 1968 and 1970, on two different networks, actually. I sometimes caught it as a kid, when ITV used to run it in late afternoon or early evenings in the early 70s. Seeing episodes again, I was surprised by how much of it I'd forgotten. That the captain, the ghost of the title, had a living a relative, for instance, Claymore, who featured very prominently in many episodes, and that Mrs. Muir actually had two young children, not just the one that I remembered. I mean, because somehow the years had erased her daughter from my memory. Derived from a novel via a 1948 film adaptation, which had starred Rex Harrison as the captain, the TV series, which updates the story to then-contemporary times, is surprisingly dark in many respects. I mean, for one thing, it centres on a male chauvinist mariner who died a century ago, having the hots for a young widow and romancing stroke stalking her in spectral form. I mean, in the first episode alone, he physically prevents her and the children from leaving his house, which they've rented from his great-nephew, by taking control of a car and steering it back to the house every time they try and get away. Whichever way you look at it, his attentions, no matter how well-intentioned they might be, are more than a little bit creepy. I mean, quite apart from the fact that Mrs. Muir has to live with the knowledge that she now lives in a house where she has no privacy, as Captain Gregg's ghost could pop up suddenly any time, any place, And you never know when he's watching you, not watching you. Then there's the matter of his campaign of terror against his great nephew, who the captain despises and feels is unworthy to bear the family name. Okay, said great nephew is a venal and deceitful creep, but I'm not sure that justifies his late relative's continuous harassment of him. So it's all pretty disturbing stuff when you think about it, but, like Mr. Ed, presented as a family-orientated sitcom. You see, those supposedly cosy old TV classics are as dark and edgy as anything the likes of Netflix produce these days.
A horse is a horse, of course, and no one can talk to a horse, of course. That is, of course, unless the horse is the famous Mr. Ed. Go right to the source and ask the horse. He'll give you the answer that you endorse. He's always on a steady course. Talk to Mr. Ed. People yakety yak the streak and waste your time a day. But Mr. Ed will never speak unless he has something to say. A horse is a horse.